He probably had another 15 minutes before the fire alarm was reported and Chetty Singh came rushing into the garage to drive to the scene of the fire. It was a long time for Daniel to wait, and he tried to put from his mind any consideration of the morality of what he was about to do. Killing Chawer had been an act of self-defence, but Daniel had killed deliberately before, during the Bush War. However, he had never derived any pleasure or satisfaction from it, as some of the others had done. Even though it had been his duty as a soldier, the sickening guilt and remorse from each episode had built up slowly within him. That guilt had contributed overwhelmingly to the final revulsion and rejection of the whole ethic of the war which had led him to join the Alpha Group. Yet here he was preparing to kill again, in a much more cold-blooded and calculating manner. Those other nameless victims that he had left as blood-soaked bundles lying in the battle-scorched veldt had been patriots too in their own light, brave black men almost certainly braver than he, who had been prepared to die for their own vision of freedom and justice. In the end, they had succeeded where he had failed. Even though long dead, their vision still burned brightly where his had dimmed and faded away. The Rhodesia he had fought for no longer existed. For him, those long-ago killings had been an obscene ritual, without passion, and, now he realized, without morality. On the other hand, could he justify what he was about to do by the memory of Johnny Inzu? Could he convince himself of the justice of it? Become executioner when no judge had passed sentence? Was there enough angry fire in his belly to carry it through? And then he remembered Mavis Inzu and her children, and the fire burned up brightly. He knew he could not turn away from it. He had to do it. He knew he would be sick with guilt after the fire of his anger had turned to cold grey ash, but he had to do it. Somewhere in the house, beyond the door, he heard a telephone ring. Daniel stirred, shaking himself like a spaniel coming from the water onto the bank, throwing off the doubts and uncertainty. He tightened his grip on the stock of the shotgun and lifted it to high port. There were hurried footsteps beyond the door. The lock turned and then it was thrown open. A man came through. The light was behind him, and for a moment Daniel did not recognise Chetty Singh without his turban. He stooped beside the Cadillac. His keys tinkled as he searched for the lock, and cursed softly when he could not find it, and turned back to the light switch on the wall. Light flooded the garage. Chetty Singh was bareheaded, his long, never-trimmed hair and beard twisted up into a top knot on his head were lightly streaked with grey. His back was still half-turned to Daniel as he fingered the bunch of keys and then thrust one of them into the Cadillac's door lock. Daniel stepped up behind him and poked the muzzle of the shotgun into his back.
"Don't do anything heroic, Mr. Singh. Mr. Purdy is looking down your spine."
Chetty Singh's body froze, but his head swiveled slowly until he was gawking at Daniel over one shoulder.
"I thought," he said, and then caught himself. Daniel shook his head. "It didn't work out that way. Chawer wasn't very bright, I'm afraid. You should have fired him a long time ago, Mr. Singh. Now move around to the other side of the car, but move slowly. Please let us keep our dignity."
He jabbed the gun into the Sikh's back, hard enough to bruise him through the thin cotton shirt, which was all he wore above a pair of khaki slacks and sandals. Chetty Singh had obviously dressed in great haste. They moved in close file around the front of the Cadillac's fancy radiator grille to the passenger door.
"Open the door, get in," Daniel instructed.
Chetty Singh settled himself on the gleaming leather upholstery and looked up into the barrel of the shotgun only inches from his face. He was sweating more heavily than the warm night air warranted. Beads of sweat twinkled on his beaky nose and slid down his cheeks into the plaited beard. He smelt of curry spices and fear, but there was a tiny spark of hope in his eyes as he offered the keys of the Cadillac to Daniel through the open door.
"Are you going to drive? Here are the keys, take them. I place myself in your hands absolutely."
"Nice try, Mr. Singh," Daniel smiled coldly. "But you and Mr. Purdy are not going to be separated for a moment. Just slide across to the driver's seat nice and slowly, all right?" Awkwardly, Chetty Singh moved his big frame across the console between the seats, grunting with the effort, and Daniel prodded him with the shotgun.
"That's it. You're doing very well, Mr. Singh."
He slid into the passenger seat as Chetty Singh settled at the wheel. He held the shotgun across his lap, out of sight of any casual observer, but with the muzzle still pushed hard into the Sikh's lower ribs. With his free hand, he closed the door.
"All right, now start up. Drive out."
As the headlights swept across the lawns, they lit the body of one of the Rottweilers lying on the grass.
"My dogs! My daughter is very fond of them."
"She has my commiserations," Daniel gave the taunt back to him. "But the animal is doped, not dead." They drove out into the street.
"My shop, my supermarket in town is on fire. I think this is your doing, Doctor. It is an investment of several millions."
"Again you have my commiserations," Daniel nodded. "It's a tough life, Mr. Singh, but worse for the insurance company than for you, I imagine. Now drive to the warehouse, please."
"The warehouse? Which warehouse?"
"Where you and Chawi and I met earlier today, Mr. Singh. That warehouse."
Chetty Singh turned in the correct direction, but he was still sweating. The smell of curry and garlic was very strong in the confined interior of the Cadillac. With his free hand, Daniel adjusted the air conditioning. Neither of them spoke, but Chetty Singh kept glancing in the rearview mirror, obviously hoping for assistance. However, the streets were deserted until they stopped at a traffic light at the entrance to the industrial area. Then, headlights flooded the interior from the rear, and a Land Rover pulled up alongside them. It was painted grey, and when Daniel glanced sideways at it, he made out the peaked cap brims of the two police constables in the front seat. Beside him he felt Chetty Singh stiffen and gather himself. Stealthily, the Sikh reached out for the door handle at his side.
"Please, Mr. Singh," Daniel said pleasantly,
"don't do it. Blood and guts all over the upholstery will ruin your caddy's resale value."
Chetty Singh deflated slowly. One of the police constables was now staring across at them.
"Smile at him," Daniel instructed.
Chetty Singh turned his head and snarled like a rabid dog. The constable looked away hurriedly. The lights changed and the Land Rover pulled forward.
"Right, let them get ahead," Daniel instructed.
At the next intersection, the police vehicle turned left.
"Yeah, you did that well," Daniel congratulated him. "I'm pleased with you."
"Why are you victimizing me in such a barbarous fashion, please, Doctor?"
"Don't spoil your record for asking facetious questions," Daniel advised him. "You know why I'm doing this."
"The ivory was no concern of yours, surely, Doctor?"
"The theft of the ivory is the concern of any decent man. But you are correct. That is not the main concern."
"The business with Chawe, that was not personal. You brought that upon yourself. You should not blame me for trying to protect myself. I am a very wealthy man, Doctor. I would be glad to make up to you any injury to your dignity or person you might have suffered. Let us discuss a figure."
$10,000. U.S., of course," Chetty Singh babbled.
"Is that your final offer?"
"I find it miserly, Mr. Singh."
"Yes, you are right. Let's say 25. No, let's... No, no, make that 50. $50,000.
"Johnny Inzu was one of the best friends I ever had," Daniel said softly. "His wife was a lovely lady. They had three children, two girls and a little boy. They named the boy after me."
"Now you have me at a loss, never mind. Who is Johnny Inzu?"
Chetty Singh asked.
"Let's say 50,000 for him as well. $100,000, I give it to you and you walk away. We forget this foolishness. It never happened. Am I correct, Doctor?"
"A little late for that, Mr. Singh. Johnny Inzu was the warden at Chawewe National Park."
Chetty Singh let out his breath softly.
"Oh, I am terribly sorry about that, Doctor. Those were not my orders."
There was the brittle edge of panic in his voice.
"I had nothing to do with that. It was the Chinaman."
"Tell me about the Chinaman."
"If I tell you, will you swear not to harm me?"
Daniel seemed to consider this at length.
"Very well," he nodded at last. "We'll go to your warehouse where we can have a private, uninterrupted chat. You'll tell me all you know about Ning Cheng Gong, and afterwards I'll release you immediately, unharmed."
Chetty Singh turned to stare at him in the reflected light from the instrument panel.
"I trust you, Dr. Armstrong. I think you are a man of integrity. I believe you will keep your word."
"To the letter, Mr. Singh," Daniel assured him. "Now just keep heading for the warehouse."
They passed the sawmills. The lumber yard was brightly lit, and the teams of sawyers were at work in the long sheds. The squeal of the saw blade slicing into timber carried clearly into the air-conditioned interior of the Cadillac.
"Business must be good, Mr. Singh. You are working night shift."
"I have a large consignment going to Australia at the end of the week."
"You will want to survive long enough to enjoy those profits. Just you keep cooperating."
At the end of the street, the warehouse stood in darkness. Chetty Singh stopped at the main gates. The gatehouse was deserted and unlit.
"Left-hand drive,"
Chetty Singh remarked, indicating the controls of the Cadillac with an apologetic shrug. "You must operate the gate from your side." He handed Daniel a plastic-coated electronic key card similar to the one retrieved from Chawe's corpse and lowered the electric window. Daniel leaned out and pressed the card into the slot of the control box. The gate boom rose and Chetty Singh drove through. Behind them, the boom dropped again automatically.
"Your guard leopard must save you a great deal in the way of wages." Daniel's tone was mild and conversational, but he kept a firm pressure of the shotgun into Chetty Singh's ribs. "But I don't understand how you have made the animal so vicious. In my experience, leopards will not attack a man unless provoked."
"That is true." Chetty Singh was more relaxed since they had struck their bargain. He had stopped sweating, and now he chuckled for the first time.
"I was advised by the man who sold it to me. Every once in a while it is necessary to give the brute a little gingering up. Never mind. I use a hot iron under its tail."
He chuckled again, this time with genuine amusement.
"My goodness, it makes the animal very angry indeed. You never heard such a racket."
"You deliberately torment it to make it vicious?" Daniel asked, shocked despite himself. His tone made evident his disgust and contempt, and Chetty Singh bridled.
"You English and your love of animals, it is merely a form of training to make it more efficient. The injuries are superficial and heal readily."
They drew up outside the warehouse, and once again Daniel used the electronic key card to open the roller door. As they drove through, the door rumbled closed behind them.
"Park over there on the loading ramp," Daniel ordered.
The headlights swept powerfully down to the girders and corrugated sheeting of the wall at the far end of the cavernous building. The floor was as cluttered as before, with a vast array of trade goods. For an instant, the leopard was caught in the full beam as the Cadillac drove onto the ramp and the headlights were deflected upwards. The great cat was crouched on the summit of a neatly squared pile of packing cases. As the light struck it, the leopard crouched, yellow-eyed, and puckered its lips into a snarl. The light glinted on its exposed canine fangs. Then it dropped out of sight behind the pile of cases.
"Did you notice the injury to its face?" Chetty Singh asked virtuously.
"You did that, and yet you accuse me of cruelty, Dr. Armstrong.
The brute is extremely aggressive and impossible to control at the moment. I may have to destroy it. It is too dangerous, even to me and my men."
"This will do," Daniel ignored the rebuke. "We can talk here. Switch off the engine and the headlights." Daniel reached up to the cabin light in the centre of the roof, and a soft glow replaced the harsh white glare as the headlights faded. They sat in silence for a while longer, and then Daniel asked quietly,
"So, Mr. Singh, how and when did you first meet Ning Cheng Gong?"
"It was about 3 years ago. A mutual friend told me he was interested in ivory and other commodities which I could supply," Chetty Singh answered.
"And what were they, these other commodities?"
When Chetty Singh hesitated, Daniel jabbed him sharply with the shotgun barrels.
"Let us both just keep to our side of the bargain," he suggested mildly.
"Diamonds," Chetty Singh wriggled away from the shotgun.
"From Namibia and Angola, emeralds from Sandwana, rare Tanzanite gemstones from the mines at Arusha in Tanzania, and some Dacha from Zululand."
"You seem to have access to many sources of supply, Mr. Singh."
"I am a businessman, Doctor. I think I am good. Probably the best. That is why Mr. Ning dealt with me."
"It was mutually beneficial, then?" Chetty Singh shrugged. "He was able to use the diplomatic bag, absolutely secure shipment."
"Except when the products were too bulky," Daniel pointed out, "as was this last consignment of ivory."
"As you say," Chetty Singh agreed. "But even then his family connections were abundantly useful. Taiwan is a convenient, shall we say, entrepot."
"Give me the details of your transactions.
Dates, commodities, values."
"But there were many," Chetty Singh protested. "I cannot remember them all."
"You've just told me that you were a good businessman," Daniel prodded him again. And Chetty Singh tried to avoid the shotgun barrel. But he was already hard up against the door and could move no further.
"I am sure you remember every single transaction."
"All right," he capitulated.
"The first was in early February 3 years ago. Ivory, value $5,000. It was a trial shipment. It went well. At the end of that month, there was a second transaction. Rhino horn and ivory, $62,000. In May of the same year, emeralds, $400,000.
Daniel had trained his memory over the years as an interviewer. He knew he could retain the details until he had a chance to write them down. The recital went on for almost 20 minutes. Chetty Singh was quick and incisive until suddenly he ended on a home note.
Then this last shipment, the one you know about.
Good, Daniel nodded.
We come to the Chowewe raid at last. Whose idea was that, Mr. Singh?
The ambassador. It was his idea,
Chetty Singh blurted.
I think you're lying.
It's highly unlikely that he could have known about the ivory go-down. Its whereabouts are not public knowledge. I think that it was more likely your area of expertise.
All right, Chetty Singh agreed. I have known about it for some years. I was awaiting an opportunity. However, Ning told me he wanted a large coup. His term of office was almost expired. He was returning home and he wanted to impress his family, his father.
But you recruited the raiders, didn't you?
Ning could not have done that. He did not have your contacts.
I didn't give the orders to kill your friend, Chetty Singh's voice trembled. I didn't want that to happen.
You were just going to leave them alive to tell their story? To explain to the police about Ning?
Yes. No, it was Ning's idea. I do not believe in killing, Doctor.
Is that why you sent Chawi and me into the mountains together this morning?
No, you gave me no choice, Dr. Armstrong. Please, you must understand I am a businessman, not a brigand.
All right, well, let's leave that for the moment. Now tell me, what was your further arrangement with Ning? Surely you were going to continue such a lucrative partnership even after he returned to Taiwan.
No.
Please don't lie to me. That is breaking our agreement. Daniel jammed the steel muzzles into him so hard that he squealed.
Yes, all right, please, you are hurting me. I can't speak if you do that.
Daniel relaxed the pressure a little.
I must warn you, Mr. Singh, that I'd be delighted if you gave me an opportunity to break our contract. Johnny Inzu's two daughters were about 10 and 8 years old. Your men raped them. His son Daniel, my godson, was just 4. They beat his brains out against the wall. It was not a pretty sight. Yes, I would enjoy it if you reneged on our bargain.
I don't want to hear these things. Please, Doctor, I am a family man myself. You must believe that I didn't want to...
Let's talk about Ning rather than your delicate sensibilities, Mr. Singh. You and Ning have plans for the future, don't you?
We have discussed certain possibilities, Chetty Singh admitted. The Ning family have vast holdings in Africa. After this last shipment of ivory, Cheng's status in the family will be absolutely enhanced. Cheng has expectations that his father will place him in charge of the Africa division of Lucky Dragon, and that is the family holding company.
You have a niche in these plans, of course, don't you? Your expert services will be in demand. Surely you've discussed it with Ning?
No.
Chetty Singh squealed again as the steel eyes of the shotgun barrels burrowed into his flesh.
Please don't do that, Doctor. I suffer from high blood pressure. This uncivilized behavior is absolutely prejudicial to my health.
What are your arrangements with Cheng? Daniel insisted. Where will you operate next?
Ubombo, Chetty Singh squeaked. Lucky Dragon plans to move into Ubombo.
Ubomo, you mean?
There was surprise in Daniel's tone.
President Omeru?
The sovereign state of Ubomo was one of the few success stories of the continent. Like Malawi, it nestled on the escarpment of the Great Rift Valley, a country of lakes and mountains on the eastern flank of Africa, where open savanna and primeval equatorial forest met. Like Hastings Bunda, President Omeru was another benevolent despot, ruling in the age-old African tradition. Thanks to him, his country was free of debt and not as yet divided or ravaged by tribal warfare. Daniel knew that Omeru lived in a small brick cottage with a corrugated iron roof and drove his own Land Rover. No marble palaces, no stretched black Mercedes, no executive jet for him. He flew to the meetings of the Organization of African Unity in the tourist class cabin of a commercial airline as a deliberate example to his people. He was a beacon of hope, not the type to deal with Lucky Dragon.
Omeru? I don't believe it, Daniel said emphatically.